Well, let's see here. This is KHEN LPFM Radio 106.9 Salida, Colorado. And it doesn't appear that my automated announcement is going to work again tonight. So I got to figure out and just go back to the old method. And you're listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KHEN LPFM Radio 106.9 Salida, Colorado. And community-supported radio, and we're streamed on the Internet at khen.org. And if you'd like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest with Melody, they're available at www.gimmesometruth.info or link from the khen.org website. And I'm Melody, and my co-host tonight is Vicki Davis. And our guests tonight are David Hawkins and Phil McConnell. And as I bring them up, then I'll go ahead and I'll be play a song here, and again, Truth Quest is supported by Apple Juice Tech, providing preventative maintenance to keep your Macs healthy for a long time. But anyways, I've already introduced you, and other than the fact that I guess what we need to do is kind of review with our audience, because we David Hawkins and Field McConnell and Vicki Davis are all returning. Vicki's been a prior guest, and tonight she's going to co-host with me. And Field McConnell and David Hawkins, would you like to do a quick brush up on what your backgrounds are, and then we'll go ahead and start right on in?
Okay. Shall I go first, Field?
Certainly.
Well, I've worked in a number of years in the international oil industry in emergency response and troubleshooting. I came to Canada in 1992. I smelt corruption on a scale I'd never seen anywhere else in the world. I got involved in forensic economics just before, 9-1-1, which is really, it's perhaps a rather big word for the idea of tracking criminal and victim assets through crime scenes, such as 9-1-1. And after 9-1-1, although I was rather lonely up here in Canada and British Columbia, I felt that there were many unanswered questions that I wasn't able to answer until I basically happened over the Internet to meet Field McConnell. We've never met in the flesh. And Field will tell you about himself, but he's basically a fighter pilot and a big jet pilot. And my background was in applied mathematics and artificial intelligence and thermodynamics, but I had no experience about how to fly a plane, although my instincts told me that the way those planes were flown on 9-1-1, they could not possibly have been flown by an inexperienced pilot. And Field introduced me to the concept of check turns, and we've been working together now for about 3 years, and we're very close to wrapping up the mystery of 9-1-1.
And the one thing David didn't tell you about himself, a couple things. Number one is he's a Cambridge University graduate, and Cambridge is one of the most prestigious schools in the United Kingdom. And he also didn't tell you that he has the ability, such as Sherlock Holmes had, to conclude what happens when the clues are not that easy to process. And that's sort of what David does, is he processes clues and evidence, and what I bring to the equation is I am a creative writer, but before becoming a creative writer 3 years ago and 3 months, when I first happened across David, as we were introduced to each other by someone following the corrupt bankrupting of United Airlines, including the portion where the bankruptcy judge was apparently given $40 million of slush money to make sure things went well. I am a representative of what I would call the global commoners, or the little people, and I can assure anyone listening to this that God is not pleased with what's going on in America and how we're treating little people, not just within our borders, but around the globe. My professional history is I'm a Naval Academy graduate from the class of 1971, the same class that had Captain Chick Burlingame, the captain of American 77, which the mainstream media has suggested hit the Pentagon, which it did not. I was in the Marine Corps for 6 years as a pilot following the Naval Academy. Following my Marine Corps service, I transferred into the North Dakota Air National Guard, where I flew fighters for the balance of my 26-year career, and those fighters included the F-4 Phantom and the F-16 Falcon. And on 9/11, the day of the attack, like everyone else in most of the world, I was glued to the TV watching these flying vehicles hit the building over and over, and I concluded that not only was it impossible for a low-time young man from a foreign country to demonstrate that amount of proficiency and precision in flying, but it's very unlikely, if not impossible, that experienced airline pilots could be that proficient at hitting such precise targets. The greatest example, of course, was not filmed, and that is whatever the flying objects, plural, were that hit the Pentagon. Oh, and my 29-year career at Northwest Airlines came to a screeching halt when I refused to be silent about the flying events of 9/11, and that does not bother me in the least. The truth is going to come out, and the truth needs to come out, I think, well before the elections of 2010.
And Vicki?
I was a computer systems analyst, programmer for 20 years, and contractor for 15 of those years. And after the year 2000, suddenly the market dried up for people with my qualifications, and I had no idea why. Ultimately, I ended up doing research on the internet after I stumbled on to the fact that IT jobs were being outsourced to India. And it not only because it affected me personally, but that was a breach of national security because our entire country runs on IT systems. And for somebody to have made the decision that it was okay to export what actually is the beating heart of any corporation, to export those jobs to India was an inexcusable breach of national security. So I started researching to see how that happened. And so, you know, and I've been, and that research has taken me from, you know, outsourcing to 911 to the North American Union, and just in so many areas, just following the systems.
And before we go any further, I just want to say the views expressed on this program are those of myself and or my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Cahen staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And at that, I'd like to go ahead and let either Field or David kind of step in to fill us into where what you guys have been up to lately, because I'll tell you, I don't think there's anybody more active on their research than you guys, because I get updates with regularity.
Yes, I think we generate a flood, Melody, and I'm very impressed because I didn't understand Vicky's background in IT, and I totally agree with her. I would go perhaps one step further, and I'd say that this was a sustained, systematic, and serial act of treason to hand off America's IT secrets because that happened at the same time with Canada and the United Kingdom and Australia. And essentially they opened a back door into, well, you call it the heart, or perhaps another word is the brain, which is the IT systems which have made America such a powerful force in the world for the good. But very interestingly, Vicky, we have an interesting connection, because Field's sister, Christine Marcy, is or was the most powerful bureaucrat in the United States administration. She was the founder of the Senior Executive Service, which is like a kind of oligarchy of bureaucrats that populate all the major agencies, including the Department of Justice and Treasury. And these are the people that do not move when the politicians come and go. So when the politicians come and go, the collective knowledge of how the American government operates in times of peace and war is stored with the senior bureaucrat in those departments. Now, Christine Marcy works with a man called Bruce McConnell, who was head of encryption for the White House in the Office of Management and Budget in the closing years of the Reagan administration, the years of the Bush senior, the two terms of the Clinton government, and just before the end of the Clinton era, he jumped ship and started his own consultancy. And if you Google Bruce McConnell and World Bank and Y2K, you'll find that he and his fellow senior executive service cohorts, including Field Sister, decided in the interest of what they call open government or open governance, that America's public key infrastructure and security codes should be shared with whoever they decided to share it with, without reference to the President of the United States and Congress. And that would appear to include China, Russia, France, and many of the parties that participated in the 9/11 attack.
Is there a field
you want to add on that?
Yeah, I would like to add one thing. Not only does it appear that these treasonous persons within the United States enabled the traitorous attacks of 9/11, but there were other countries that stood by and benefited, and you failed to mention China, I think, David. Maybe I missed you when you said China, but China and Russia certainly benefited, as did France. But the majority of the operations were brokered and engineered out of Canada, which the Canadian-American border, which is the 49th parallel, is the longest undefended border in the world, and I think we're about 9 years late in arming that border, because that attack came right out of Canada, not only in terms of money engineering software, but also the flying hardware. Numerous of the airplanes that are unknown to most of the people listening to your show were launched out of Canada. That's what I would add.
Well, you know, it's very interesting that you would say the word open government, because I was doing some research today, and it appears that Mikhail Gorbachev's peace prize that he won in, what was it, 1990? I found an article where he was talking about open skies, open government, open. You know, there were about four opens, and I tried to find that article before the program because, I don't know, I just thought it might come up. But in 1990, the first Bush, or maybe it was in the late 80s, the first Bush was the guy who negotiated with Gorbachev on the what was supposed to be the arms limitation, but apparently that's when they decided to go along with the open government, and I suspect that that's when they decided on e-government, and I really do believe that the United States was suckered.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, and if I could... it may help your listeners, Melody, if we just give our website, because some of them, at least if they're in front of the computer, they can look at the website. And if I may, with your permission, I'll go to the website myself while your readers, those who are near their computer, go to it. And then I could quickly show them the highlights of this website. We're now on our fifth book, but I think the images there will help them enormously. Is that all right?
Oh, that's please do. And anytime during the this evening, you can go ahead and bring it up again just to kind of remind them.
Okay. Well, we have two websites, and the first one is Captain Sherlock, which is one word, two components, captain as in leader, Field McConnell, captain of an airplane, and Sherlock like Sherlock Holmes. So, if you will, that's our avatar or teacher. So none of us represent all the qualities of leadership and Sherlock Holmes' skills, but everyone has a combination of those skills, and in my experience, we're all leaders if we find our niche. I personally am very happy to follow in many areas. In fact, when I worked in the UK, there was a petrophysicist I worked for, and he had a sign on his door, lead, follow, or get out of the way. And I think for so many of us, we're always struggling, or we think we want to be leaders, and there's many times, I think, when we can get out of the way. So I have a tendency to drone on, and Phil tries to cut in there. But anyway, by the by, so CaptainSherlock.com. I don't know if either of you near a computer you can see that site. Can you see what I'm talking about? CaptainSherlock.com.
I've been there, yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. I try not to bring up too much of that stuff because it starts causing problems with the computer and Skype.
Okay. All right. So there are 8 icons, square blocks, on this website, and behind them is an enormous amount of information, but I'll just go across some of the highlights. The first book we wrote was called Hunter's Wingman. And Hunter's Wingman, it's partly fiction, partly fact, but the first chapter has a very interesting meeting between two quasi-fictional characters, which some people might say are modeled on myself and Phil McConnell. And we meet at a pub up here in British Columbia, and it's a casual drink, New Year's Eve party, and we start discovering that we have some information. This is December 31st, 2000, just before the great year, or the terrible year that brought in 911. And we meet in the context of serial killings that took place in British Columbia at a pig farm, where prostitutes were taken from the downtown east side, taken out of the pig farm and slaughtered in what appears to be oath-taking and ceremonies and cannibal festivals. And what we're discussing there is, sorry, I hope this doesn't upset your listeners, the idea of entrapping people, perhaps when they're young, perhaps when they've drunk too much, perhaps when they're full of cocaine or marijuana, and get them into a situation where the camera is turning, and they do things that ordinarily they would never do, but when they wake up or realize what they've done, someone has got a film, possibly a snuff film, involving them not necessarily participating in the killing of someone, but witnessing it. And what I suggest to you is that that person is then owned for the rest of their life, whether they make a career in information technology or the aerospace industry or government or whatever. And we think that idea of getting people entrapped in an oath-taking ceremony and taking an image of them dates back more than 200 years to the United Kingdom, where there were famous clubs called the Hellfire Clubs, where aristocrats would bring in peasant children or whatever to their seats, and these sacrifices or whatever would take place, and obviously there weren't movies back then. But fast forward to 1815, in the Battle of Waterloo, by then the Rothschild family, or Nathaniel Rothschild, had got probably the world's leading intelligence service in Europe. And at the Battle of the Waterloo, you know that the British, under the Duke of Wellington, won and the French lost. But what Nathaniel Rothschild was able to do, he got news that the British had won the day before the government officers reached London. So Nathaniel Rothschild had his agents at the London Stock Exchange, and they started selling shares and bonds and encouraging people to believe that the British had lost and there was going to be a collapse in the value of English companies and so on. But of course he knew they'd won. So that took off like a panic in the market, and the London stock market collapsed, and the value of the bonds collapsed, and at a secret moment, Nathaniel Rothschild triggered to his agents to start buying. And in 1815, the Rothschild took over the Bank of England. Now, the reason I tell you that story is, on 9/11, Nathaniel Rothschild, who's the great-great-great-great-great-whatever grandson of the Nathaniel Rothschild who made a killing in the Battle of Waterloo with a good intelligence network, Nathaniel Rothschild, who was at Oxford University, had built a network with his family that gave him prior intelligence of the attack planned to overthrow the government of the United States on 9/11. And Rothschild's agents were selling through 9/11. They arranged for the New York Stock Exchange to shut down for 4 days. And at a suitable moment, they started buying. Obviously, there's a huge panic associated with the 9/11 attack. And they ended up effectively owning America. And the wealth of the United States in the aftermath of 9/11 was transferred to London.
I was wondering if that kind of stock manipulation, if maybe they weren't involved in the market during the dot-com
they were
boom and bust, because the same thing happened. I mean, the IBM's stock was driven down to a value of about $40 a share in the early 1990s, and there was no reason for it other than rumor.
Well, this is what they call a naked short selling attack on a company with saboteurs. But you make a very good point, because what I want to do, and feel jump in any time, is make a connection between what the Rothschild, or the House of Rothschild, did in 1815 and what the House of Rothschild, interestingly enough, the same name, Nathaniel Rothschild, in 2001, that the techniques they used to destroy or take over the Bank of England in 1815 are exactly the same techniques that they used to destroy and take over the United States Treasury in 9/11. Now, let's follow the Rothschilds a little bit through the 19th century. They found a promising young man in South Africa by the name of Cecil Rhodes, who was a very entrepreneurial character, and the Rothschild family financed Cecil Rhodes in terms of working pumps to eliminate flooding in reserves or resources where they found some diamonds. And ultimately, the Rothschilds financed Cecil Rhodes to come to Oxford University, where he joined what we think is the secret society that was instrumental in planning the 9/11 attack, and that is called the Bullingdon Club. Bullingdon. And the Bullingdon Club started off around 1780, just after the War of Independence, as a drinking club and cricketing club. By the time that Cecil Rhodes joined it, that was 1876, he was being financed already then by the Rothschild, the House of Rothschild, in his attempts to develop the diamond industry in South Africa. In 1877, Cecil Rhodes wrote a secret will where he said, and don't think for a moment that I share his opinions, but what he said was, wherever you go in the world, at the top of the tree, except for science, you find an Oxford man. That is a man from Oxford University. So what Cecil Rhodes decided is that what the world really needed was what he called an imperial parliament. That is, America would come back into the fold of the English-speaking peoples, being controlled out of London, i.e. cancel the War of Independence, and America's interests would be represented by one or two or three business people who would periodically come to the United Kingdom to agree on how the United States should be administered. Remember, we're talking 1876-7, the secret will. And similarly, Australia and Canada and the various colonies in different parts of the world. But he already had recognized that the, I think he was around 23, 24, 25, and quite possibly had coined the term the New World Order. So from 1877 through to 1902, he grew the De Beers Diamond Company into a global monopoly. I think it had about 90% of the world trade in diamonds. And he ruthlessly enforced that monopoly with the help of the Rothschild family. In 1902, the Rothschilds, using the estate of Cecil Rhodes, launched the Rhodes Scholarship Scheme. And we believe the Rhodes Scholarship Scheme, combined with the Bullingdon Club at Oxford University, became the basis for recruiting agents for the New World Order. And Senator Fulbright, I believe, in 1927, became a Rhodes Scholar. And at Oxford University, what we think is happening through the Bullingdon Club is various promising people are forced or tricked into taking a blood oath, meaning they're promised huge wealth and huge power, provided they keep everything about the Rothschild and the Bullingdon Club secret. And you can imagine that with Rothschild money behind you, you can become very wealthy, very powerful. In fact, the sky is the limit. So in 1969, the Bullingdon Club at Oxford University, which controls the Rhodes Scholarship Scheme with the Rothschilds, brings in a man by the name of Bill Clinton, who is a rapist, drug trafficker, and traitor. And they groom him to become the President of the United States. Now, the 1947 Fulbright program was also financed by the Rothschild, the House of Rothschild, and controlled by the House of Rothschild. And the Fulbright program is very interesting because it gives a network to move agents, saboteurs, assassins, and deception experts in and out of the United States through your university system. So in 1979, at Occidental College in California, they recruit another agent for effectively the Bullingdon, Rothschild, Rhodes, and Fulbright network. And that agent in 1979 is a man by the name of Barry Switoro. Does that ring a bell?
Yes.
Barry Switoro was then moved through the university system in the United States and groomed and trained by the Rothschilds to become a top-ranking saboteur, assassin, and deception expert. And in 1981, he was sent to Pakistan to work with his mother, Ann Dunham, and a man who was then moving Stinger missiles into Afghanistan with the CIA to help eject the Soviet army from Afghanistan. And Barry Switoro went on a hunting trip paid for by the Rothschilds and Bullingdon and law firm, Sidley Austin of Chicago, and met with a man whose name, as far as the CIA was concerned, was Tim Osmond. Does that ring a bell?
Yes.
Yeah, that's Osama bin Laden,
yes.
Right?
Yes, okay. Osama bin Laden. So Osama bin Laden and Barack Obama, back then Tim Osmond and Barry Switora, financed by the Rothschilds and the Bullingdon Sidley Austin law firm, met and began a project which would one day lead to the 9/11 attack. Now, I'm going on a bit here. Phil, do you want to jump in, or am I doing all right?
I think you're explaining it well. And I just want to point out that if it seems like I'm awfully silent, I am often silent. However, I also am the one who carries lawsuits into the federal courthouses, which I've done 3 times now. And you can find those lawsuits at the top and the bottom of the homepage of www.captainsherlock.com. And also, David and I would be remiss if we didn't point out that once we get done talking about Osama and Obama, and it's time for the pajamas, we also will point out that we have an Able Danger blog spot that's being replicated in Japan, Norway, England, soon to be Russia, we believe, hopefully India, and Australia and New Zealand. So the Anglosphere, or the English-speaking world, is going to have many ways of following our investigations. And while David sort of mans the office day-to-day, I do a little bit of traveling, and I've done some very interesting traveling in the last 3 months. For those people who like intelligence-type work. But one of the places I traveled to was the National Convention of the Tea Party in Nashville, Tennessee, on the first 3 or 4 days of February of this. Well, that was just last month.
Field, can I get and Vicki the same, when you guys speak, just speak up a little louder because your volume levels aren't quite up like the rest of them. Okay, so,
okay, I was just pointing out that David does a lot of the thinking and a lot of the dot connecting, and I do a lot of the traveling and attending things that are remote. For instance, I spent 18 months in Kazakhstan, and sometime tonight we may share with your audience what a Khazar, a Khazar, is. It seems that a lot of otherwise well-informed Americans have never heard the Khazar term, and it's a term that is central to the understanding of the bank and court system takeover of the United States of America. But now that I've given David a breather, I'll turn it back over to him, and he'll speak loud, I promise. And he can't hear very well, so if he needs to be cut in on, you might hear me use the term fire hose, because like any of Pavlov's dog, I've got David trained, if he hears fire hose, to stop speaking, even if he can't hear anything else.
I'm totally controlled, Melanie. Dominate. Everyone dominates me. But anyway, so let's keep going. So we've now got a point in time in 1815 where the House of Rothschilds have built a superb, for the time, intelligence service that allows it to get the early warning of a major event and therefore manipulate the stock market. And the interesting thing about criminals is, and I'm not saying that the entire Rothschild family is criminal, but there's a very important concept in American law called a racketeering influence and corrupt organization. And this will be the key that unlocks this process, because if you grow up, as I say, in the Rothschild family, you are not automatically a criminal by virtue of being a member of the Rothschild family. If, however, you embrace their way of doing business, which involves insider trading or outsider trading or churning or pumping and dumping or money laundering, then you may effectively find yourself in court one day, quite possibly in a civil claim, which is the one that Field McConnell filed in Fargo, North Dakota, on the 1st of May 2007, where we have a number of people identified. The list is about 100 strong. It includes Field's sister, and it includes Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton and various Republicans and Democrats. But at that time, and that was back in 2007, we didn't realize this connection led back to the United Kingdom, and specifically to the Rhodes Scholarship Scheme and the Bullingdon Club and blood oath-taking ceremonies in the House of Rothschild. Incidentally, Rothschild is Red Child. Sorry,
what was your clue, David? Was it that children's charity?
The clue when we discovered the Rothschilds?
The connection going back to Great Britain.
Well, that's an excellent question. And that was one of the references that Field made about my skills. And if I'd have them, I'm very appreciative of his recognizing it. And if I do have them, they're a gift from God. They're not something, it's not my property. But the best expression of the skill that I think I might have developed or improved was in a book by Arthur Conan Doyle called Study in Scarlet, Sherlock Holmes, mystery, thriller, if you will. And I'm quoting from memories, but towards the end of that book, when Sherlock Holmes is addressing an audience of policemen, and he always delighted in not telling the police that they're stupid, but always pointing out why they didn't get to the solution, and he did. And what he says was, in the story, there are many people in life who you give them a series of events and they will tell you what comes to pass. There are very few who, given an event, will tell you the circumstances which led up to it. And when you think about it, that's what makes a good detective, if you will. And that's what always holds our attention. Those people who like reading Sherlock Holmes stories, you're given clues, and then gradually it drops into pace, and a little bit comes from the author and the fictional character, Sherlock Holmes, and a little bit comes from yourself, but a lot of people in all kinds of ages and walks of life around the world, I believe the Sherlock Holmes stories are amongst the most read in the world, they love that process. So what Field and I say is, okay, we may not be a Sherlock Holmes, but all of those qualities can improve with practice. Now, after 911, in the Time magazine, about a week or a month after 911, the man who used to be known as Tim Osmond, who went on the hunting trip with Barry Sweatero, your president, just south of Quetta in Pakistan, he's quoted as saying, we have three independent networks to move Al-Qaeda assets around the world, and all the resources of the British and the Americans cannot stop us. I'm a Brit. I'm now a Canadian citizen. Field is American. And when the man who allegedly took out your American command centers and killed nearly 3,000 of your citizens says that, I believe we should infer that when someone boasts about what they've done after the fact, they're probably speaking something much closer to the truth than what they say they're going to do before the fact.
I'm a big believer in believing what people say, especially if they're in a position to know.
Well, he was boasting. So, you know, it was the first flush of hubris or pride after pulling off his extraordinary project, if you will, of taking down the most powerful military power in the world, the most powerful government in the world, the most powerful country in the world. How did he do it? From a cave in Pakistan or cave in Afghanistan? Well, he didn't. Now, the interesting thing about the statement, we have three independent networks to move Al-Qaeda assets around the world and all the resources of the British and the Americans cannot stop us. First of all, well, it tells us a number of things, if he's actually speaking the truth, and I believe he was speaking the truth. First of all, we shouldn't assume that because he thinks the networks are independent, they really are. Because if they were three independent networks, how would you coordinate them to pull off this amazing attack? So what we believe now is that those three networks come together at a certain place and a certain time with certain people. Now, what are the assets needed for a force to take over and, for example, target and destroy not just a section of the Pentagon under construction And incidentally, let me just remind you, in 1972, Bernardine Dorn and the Weather Underground bombed the Pentagon.
They did?
That's important, isn't it?
Well, yes.
Because she didn't destroy the Pentagon. She didn't destroy the Pentagon then, but in 9/11, she did.
I guess I'm a little bit behind the eight ball on that one.
In 1972, the Weather Underground, operated out of Chicago, allegedly bombed a washroom in the Pentagon.
Wow, I didn't know that.
So, in 9/11, America didn't just lose a section of Wedge 1 in the Pentagon that was under construction. You lost the U.S. Naval Command Center. And the weapon that went across the Pentagon lawn at 540 miles an hour went straight between the eyes of the duty officer of the U.S. Naval Command Center in the Pentagon, and his name is Captain Gerald DeConto.
You know, that's one thing that I've never gotten a good answer on or good resolution to. Some people say that it was the Army data center, but when I first read about it, it was a Navy data center. Have you? It is.
It was the U.S. Navy Command Center that was under construction by a British company called AMEC, of which the major shareholder was Goldman Sachs.
Oh, man. Well, isn't that
so? A very interesting question I put to my American friends is, surely to God, you need to know what happened to the functions of the U.S. Naval Command Center when they were destroyed on 9/11, because the U.S. Naval Command Center is the link between your president and U.S. naval assets around the world. It's kind of important from a strategic point of view, right? What happened to the functions? So, again, going back to the Sherlock Holmes, why aren't senior officers in the United States military asking that question? Or at least if they are, they're not asking this or publishing the fact to the public at large. Conversely, why aren't intelligent citizens and educated citizens who have a concern about security asking, well, who took over the functions that were previously or services provided by the U.S. Naval Command Center and the Pentagon? That links the President of the United States, your Commander-in-Chief, to U.S. naval assets around the world, which is your principal competitive advantage if ever it comes to a shooting match.
You don't think they turned it over to one of these global systems places? Well, they turned over Internet security to the OECD, so...
I think they turned it over to the United Kingdom and the Rothschild family.
Oh, God.
So, anyway, go ahead, Phil.
Let me point out two things, David. Number one, these ladies need to understand, if they don't already understand, that by treaty between Henry Shelton, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and General Maurice Barril, Mauricebarril, up in Canada, the airspace over North America, including all of the United States of America, was protected by Canada, not the United States of America, for a 30-hour period. And so the United States decision-makers either naively or corruptly entrusted the aerial sovereignty of the United States of America to General Maurice Barril. And during that 30-hour period, 9/11, the treason of 9/11 occurred. And just to show you how it's almost impossible that any young Muslim pilots could have been participating. On the morning of 9/11, the Pentagon had approximately 7,754 windows. That's 7,754 windows. This flying vehicle, which the mainstream media suggests is Captain Chick Burlingame 757, was maneuvered through one window out of 7,754, which behind the open window held the command function of the U.S. Navy. The odds of that happening are just about zero, not because it's one window out of 7,754, but rather because a 757 couldn't fly that low across the grass without digging holes in the grass and still stick its nose in the window. So the fairy tale of 9/11 is going to come crashing down around the feet of the perpetrators, and I'll turn it back over to David.
Well, let me just ask a question here, too. Isn't the North American skies now under Canadian and American partnership?
It has been for over 50 years.
For 50 years?
It's always been a partnership.
Okay, but now... I was under this understanding that it's more than just that, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Well, you see, you're right, Vicki, because what's happening is you worked in IT. Are you familiar with geographic information systems?
Sure, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, a geographic information system, back in my younger days, I was coordinator of artificial intelligence for geoscience research at Schlumberger Doll Research Center in Connecticut. So my business back then was looking at the old systems, GIS, geographic information systems, and turning them into real-time models that could be visualized on a computer screen and handled just like the real world. Anyway, I made a lot of progress there, but... what you can do in the oil industry below the ground with reservoirs is you can create a database called a geographic information systems where different layers of the rock are represented, and when you're visualizing it, you can tune out a layer and tune in a layer and create a visual effect of an underground reservoir through a GIS. Exactly the same thing up in the air. The people who do air traffic control and the military and the United States allies, the United Kingdom, and under the Partnership for Peace, the NATO Partnership for Peace, which was launched, but again, we believe, treasonously by Bill Clinton, you have in the United States at any time Ukrainians and Georgians and various other parties, no due diligence, engaged in using geographic information systems that present an image of what's going on in American airspace. And there was another group of people loose in the United States at that time, and that was the United Nations Monitoring and Verification and Inspection Commission that was supposed to be looking at whether or not Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. They'd been trained in Canada, and they were actually, in fact, working on the airspace in the United States from a geographic information system called Weather Exchange, WEATHERXCHANGE. Now, before I go into details about the Weather Exchange, let me take you back to the Rothschilds in the Second World War. Now, in the Second World War, the Rothschilds had continued to develop their intelligence network in Europe, the one they used in 1815 to basically wipe out the Bank of England. And during the Second World War, the Rothschilds still had, enormously more powerful, the most effective military intelligence system available for them to determine what they were going to invest in, including crematoria and gas chambers. Now, what's extraordinary is that the Met Office, the Meteorological Office in the United Kingdom, which was founded in 1850, by certainly the First World War and absolutely fundamental in the Second World War, had become a weapon of deception. Because what you could do with the Met Office and its computer, well, I don't know how sophisticated the computers were, but the Met Office during the Second World War was staffed by brilliant people. It had Navy captains and Royal Air Force pilots and Allied bombers all sending information about cloud formations, wind speed, temperature, humidity, visibility, etc. And very, very sharp people in the Met Office in the United Kingdom working out what the weather would be like for particular missions, including D-Day. And they had so much power and their knowledge was so great that they persuaded Eisenhower to delay the D-Day landing by one day because they saw a weather opportunity that would improve the safety and effectiveness of the landing. Now, you can think of it conversely, is if they're broadcasting information to the Germans, which make the Germans believe that the weather on the real D-Day was going to be too bad to do a landing, the Germans are going to relax. You see my point?
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, going back to 9-1-1, if Osama bin Laden really did believe that he had three independent networks to move his assets in place for the 9-1-1 attack, he would know that no matter how effective those assets and the networks were, he didn't have the power to deliver the weaponry if America was on guard, if you see my point. Conversely, America would not be expecting an attack from a low-time terrorist group on its key command centers if the weather was really good, because Americans would be confident that they could shoot down anything that they could see, and if they were being attacked by some clown from a cave in Afghanistan, there wouldn't be many weapons getting through. Now, on 9-1-1, the Met Office and the Rothschild Bank and the Ministry of Defense in the United Kingdom and various traitors inside the United States and Canada had developed a weather forecasting system, which was basically a geographic information system, called the Weather Exchange. And what the Weather Exchange did is it created a layer inside the geographic information system that with encryption could be presented to the people in America who were playing on the blue team war game. And basically created what we call virtual weather. So your blue team defenders, including Captain Gerald Ocondo, the duty officer in the U.S. Naval Command Center of the Pentagon, believed it was a clear day, and it was a clear day. So he believed that there was no way during this war game a single small terrorist group with limited technology could get through and take him out. So we think he was very relaxed because he was looking at a particular facet, if you will, of the weather exchange, which showed the area or the space around the Pentagon being clear of weapons. And whatever was in that space was... Go ahead.
I'm sorry, was Ducanto the young captain that was the first day on the job?
Yes, he was the duty officer.
Okay, okay.
His nickname was Fish.
Fish, huh?
And he was at the U.S. Naval Academy, but not in the same year as Field was.
He was in the class of 1979 at the U.S. Naval Academy, and while that may not be significant, some of these onerous groups that have infested our government at the highest level, including the Senior Executive Service and also an organization of ill-tempered women called FemComp, Inc., both of those horrific organizations were created in 1979, also the same year that Fish got out of the Naval Academy, and that was the last class of the service academies that were all male. And I'm not a sexist by any means. I have a wife and four daughters, all of whom are certified females. But what's going on in America's infrastructure and command and control center has been really mucked. That's M-U-C-K-E-D, mucked up, and that's a British term, by the ramming fast forward of previously inexperienced people into positions of high authority for which they have no background, and such is the case of the lady who was sitting on top of the FAA on 9/11. And
true. You're absolutely right, and that is the Six Sigma program that they implemented, that the same thing as TQM. And that was intentional, well, I think, so that they could a coup d'etat.
It absolutely was, and once again, I want to assure both Melody and Vicki that I have great respect for women, and we're ordained to have respect for women, but women, conversely, we're supposed to have mutual respect. We're different yet equal characters, and our Creator designed it that way. So to fast forward certain women, including my sister was propelled from being a 21-year-old Georgetown graduate with a Master in Foreign Service into a series of ever-increasing responsibility, all of which positioned her to be entrapped or extorted into service that's not in the best keeping of the traditions of American service people or my McConnell family surname.
There wasn't any relation. Now, I may have asked you this before, but there wasn't any relationship between you and Bruce McConnell.
No, that my sister used to work for Bruce McConnell and probably still does. It's a little murky. But the relationship between the McConnells is that in the mid-60s, Bruce McConnell's father was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. His name was General John P. McConnell, and a four-star general in the Air Force. At the same time, my father, who was a colonel, was stationed at Hickam Air Force Base in Hawaii and or Rainey Air Force Base in Puerto Rico. And the McConnell name, and I'm not hung up on that name, I just happened to have inherited it. But if you start Googling McConnells in the Air Force history, you find a whole lot of interesting characters, and none of us are related. We just share a common surname, but we don't necessarily play on the same team.
Okay. Let me go ahead and say this is KHENLPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado. And we're community-supported radio, and we're streamed on the Internet at khen.org. And if you'd like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest with Melody, they're available at www.gimmesometruth.info or linked from the khen.org website. And the views expressed on this program are those of myself and or my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And support for KHEN and TruthQuest is brought to you by Apple Juice Tech, providing preventative maintenance to keep your Macs healthy for a long time. Apple Juice Tech provides service, consulting classes, one-on-one training, and remote support with a secure connection to your Mac. Phone 719-966-7323 or email tech at applejuicetech.net. And my co-host tonight is Vicki Davis, and our guests are David Hawkins and Bruce or Field McConnell. Too many McConnells here now.
Oh, that's okay. I've met Bruce McConnell, and he's met me.
Okay. And so they're kind of filling us in on some different perspectives on the 9/11 and a lot of other events going on in the world here. So go ahead.
Okay, so let's keep anchoring at that alleged boast by Osama bin Laden a few days after the 9/11 attack. We have three independent networks to move al-Qaeda assets around the world, and all the resources of the British and the Americans cannot stop us. Now, I believe that the Brits and the Americans are wedded at the hip, if you will. I saw the most amazing little monument in Ridgefield in Connecticut, it was up in the woods behind a pub. And there was obviously some fighting going on in the War of Independence, and the British, the monument said something to the effect, obviously some the Americans had left the monument. The British who died here came our enemies and they stayed our guests, you know, which was an incredibly elevated way of respecting your enemy, because the Brits and the Americans, as I say, we've been friends for hundreds of years, but there are people who actually have an interest in destroying that friendship and driving a wedge in between two countries, what the Winston Churchill famously called the English-speaking peoples, or perhaps another word is the Anglosphere. And I'm not being jingoistic here. I'm saying, you know, the life, liberty, security of the person, enjoyment of property, pursuit of happiness, innocent until you're proven guilty, all these wonderful things that stretch back to Magna Carta and so on, have created an incredible force for good in the world. Now, these people, they don't want these networks that have been created. They're about destroying that force for good, and they're well on the way to doing it in the United States. So, going back to this network, he talks about three independent networks. Initially, we thought that might be an air, a naval, and a ground-based network. But I think we've now decided that there were three different kind of assets moving on the networks. One is money, i.e. it was a financial network or financial intelligence network. The second is a human intelligence network, i.e. there are people who are being trained in sabotage, assassination, and deception, and they're moving without interception along those networks, and those networks, we think, date back to 1815 and before. And then there's electronic networks or electronic warfare and electronic intelligence. And just like Vicky said at the beginning, the IT of a country, particularly the United States, is its competitive advantage. It's its soul. It's its brain. And you've made amazing advances, as did the British, the Turing machine and some of the early computers. And hand in hand through the Second World War with radar and so on, electronic intelligence and electronic warfare tools had become extraordinarily advanced in an atmosphere of mutual trust between Canada, Australia, the United Kingdom, and America. And I believe it was called Echelon, is one of these intelligence networks. Now, you can see that if you can insert a virtual weather picture in the minds of the defender so that they think the weather would not support an enemy attack from behind, so to speak, because if an enemy attacked from behind, it would essentially be a small terrorist group and they wouldn't want to come, you know, if the sun was shining. If you can create that impression and take over, for example, the weather as seen by Chick Burlingham, who was Field McConnell's classmate at the U.S. Naval Academy, who was flying Flight 77 that allegedly hit the Pentagon. If you can take over what I think is called technically the command, control, communications, computers, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance system at a certain layer, which is the layer of the weather exchange, you can give the impression to Chick Burlingham that there are obstacles ahead and he has to take evasive maneuvers.
Well, that certainly would be a company like Cisco, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. Very interesting you mentioned Cisco. I'll come to that in a minute. Well, actually, I'll just make a reference about Cisco. Cisco has come up with a concept called the planetary skin. Have you heard of that?
Oh, you know, I saw that website, but I can't recall what it was about. You'll have to remind me.
Well, it's the totality of internet routers and switchgear and the ability to basically monitor any email or communication gives the person able to do the monitoring access to a planetary skin where an individual citizen can be accused of violating some principle, like producing too much carbon dioxide.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Okay.
Vicky, speak up a little bit again when you're...
Yeah, I was just recalling that, and that's the whole system that they're going to use to control people.
It's already built.
Through their use of energy, through just living and breathing, they're going to...
Right. Now, Peel, jump in here if I get the terminology right. There is a term in military sense called friend or foe recognition or identification software. And this is very important because over the United States airspace at any time, you have predominantly a group of friends. That is, pilots inside legal passenger aircraft flying American citizens from A to B quite lawfully. And what the systems that have been programmed by the military are supposed to do is recognize friends as friends and enemies or foes as enemies or foes and treat them very differently. If, however, you can get inside the friend or foe recognition software and the command and control system and trick the blue team defenders into treating a passenger aircraft as an enemy because it hasn't obeyed a command, you can actually, if you're very slick, get the United States government to authorize the destruction of a friendly passenger aircraft because it thinks and its chain of command people believe that this has been hijacked.
I wonder, you remember that airplane that supposedly a Chinese fighter pilot nicked the wing on and the pilot ended up landing on Canaan Island?
Yes, it was a Navy P-3. That was a Navy P-3 you're alluding to.
Yeah. I've wondered if they, when the Chinese stripped that airplane, if they took out of that aircraft, whatever the device is that says friend or foe?
No, they did not. That was just some clumsy flying by the Chinese Air Force. That was an accident, and they weren't smart enough or powerful enough to do any damage to the infrastructure of the Navy airplane other than to cause it to land somewhere else. But what they did put in jeopardy was the secret hardware and the documents on board the aircraft. However, the Navy crewman on that aircraft, which was a Lockheed P-3 Orion, they did have adequate time to destroy all the classified documents on the aircraft when that occurred, but it was really not so significant since President Clinton and his chief of staff, John Shalashkashvili, had given all the secrets to China in 1995, if my mind isn't skipping a year, David. 1995, was it?
No, that's right. Clinton treasonously sent the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, John Shalikashvili, in 1995 to give a presentation to the People's Liberation Army in Beijing, the university. And again, this is quoting from memory, but what Shalikashvili said to the Communist Chinese Party leaders and the bosses of the People's Liberation Army, before I leave here, I have been authorized to give you details of all America's weapons programs.
Oh, jeez.
So they handed over your heart, your soul, your life, your stability, and your security to the Communist Chinese. Now,
well, Shalikashvili is the guy who
Shalikashvili.
Shalikashvili is the guy who came up with the design for the what he called the focused logistics system, which is actually a dual-use kind of system. And I saw a term for it recently called log war, but it's logistics and war fighting. And it does essentially the same thing. You know, it's full-spectrum dominance, total domain awareness, and basically tracking of freight. It's the software and hardware that they have in the fusion centers.
Yeah, these are the fundamental elements of the planetary skin, which is a global monitoring system that monitors every piece of information moving from A to B in every citizen and arbitrarily determines whether or not they've violated some particular condition, which allows the computer to switch them from friend to foe. You see, if, for example, an Alpha pilot like Field or Chick Burlingham is, through encryption, given an instruction to make an evasive maneuver, or perhaps told, there is a threat to the White House, do not enter this space. And his autopilot has been hacked by encryption, courtesy of Bruce McConnell. The enemy can actually take control of the plane and fly it through maneuvers that make the friend or foe detection software of the Americans believe that the friendly plane has been hijacked or switched to a foe status, and therefore it is destroyed by the defending forces, even though it's not a foe, it's a friend.
Is that the kind of system that you worked on?
Yes. Well, when I was working in artificial intelligence, to my horror, what I developed for Schlumberger in 1981, and I wrote a paper on artificial intelligence in 1983 that was published internationally, but I quit Schlumberger in 1981 because I sensed, I couldn't put my finger on it, that the work which was absolutely fundamental to this scam, and I didn't call it virtual deception because my intentions were honorable. I wanted people to get a clear understanding of what was taking place in the subsurface of oil fields. But the work I did was sufficiently powerful to give people with less honorable motives an opportunity to create, well, if you can, if you would like to think of it as a virtual oil field. So they could make the international oil industry believe that there was either more oil or less oil available for to meet the demand. Now, you can see the power of that. You can manipulate prices.
Well, you know what? In my research, everything that I've researched goes back to computer fraud as being the basis for it, and that includes government reports. It includes the dot-com stock scam. It includes the oil market and the whole concept of the new economy based on the internet, which is really just a corporate backbone. Everything is based on computer fraud.
Well, I think you're right. But and so in order to get our head around the throat of this beast, we have there are many different kinds of computer fraud, and I'm not an expert on virtual deception. But just going back to the Second World War, there was another extraordinary story, and the film, I believe, was called The Man Who Never Was. I don't know if you've ever heard of that film, but it's an extraordinary film. And I, from memory, it relates to the landings in Sicily. And the Allies wanted the Germans to believe that the landing would take place at one beach, and whereas the real landings would take place at another. That is the idea, and the same with the D-Day landings, that the Germans would divert their forces to a virtual beach where the landing would not take place, leaving the beach where the landing would take place relatively undefended. And the same logic with D-Day. So what they did is they took a man who died of pneumonia, and they gave him false papers. And apparently when you die of pneumonia, your lungs fill up water, and it looks very similar to a drowning. And the Met Office, again, in the UK, worked out the tides and the weather and so on. And they released the body with some maps and instructions, top secret information, from a submarine. And the body washed up real close to where the Germans had an observation base. The body was picked up. The Germans presumably did an autopsy. And checked the instructions, and they moved their forces to defend the wrong beach.
Yeah.
And you could argue that this whole operation was coordinated through the United Kingdom Met Office, because they needed the weather, the tides, etc., etc. So, you can see that intelligence, or IT, becomes a weapon.
Yes. Well, yeah, it probably would have been better to say illusions, because they're creating illusions. It's just that the computer systems make it so much easier, you know.
Yeah, but the military term is called virtual deception.
Oh, good term. I like that.
Now, virtual deception, back in World War II, was already a very sophisticated and powerful concept, and there were two people who were key to the development of virtual deception techniques in the Second World War. One of them was a man by the name of David Bowes Leon, who's related to the British royal family. And he was at Oxford University, and he was a member of this Bullingdon Club, which we believe is financed by the House of Rothschild. And he joined the Special Warfare Executive in the United Kingdom during the war, and he worked with the BBC and the Ministry of Defense and the OSS, which is the Office of Strategic Services at 30 Rockefeller Plaza. And he worked with photo reconnaissance, etc. And he created virtual deception. So the Germans, in order to destroy their morale, would see images and pictures of cities that had been destroyed by Allied bombing. They hadn't been touched.
Wow.
That's very powerful. All right. He created perceptions amongst the Germans that the Allies would land at one beach in Sicily or another beach in the D-Day landings. And the Germans were played like a fiddle, and they moved their resources and their tanks and their defensive structures to the wrong place.
Did they just kind of like use Hollywood for some of the stuff too?
Yes, very much so, and that's a good question, because there's a key technology that runs right through the assassination of John F. Kennedy and the murder of Sharon Tate in 1969, and Field's father, when he would have come back and claimed that he had managed to shoot down a four-engine bomber from another four-engine bomber, would have used this technology. And this is the technology of Bell and Howell, the middle of the last century's greatest maker of cameras, film cameras.
And you know,
go ahead.
It's the power of illusion. People remember images much more than they do if reading something. And if you can put a false image in their mind, then it acts on them even when they're not really aware of it.
Vicki, you're absolutely right. Go ahead.
Yeah, a picture is worth a thousand words.
But very important, you see, is the terminology of virtual deception. For example, everyone knows there was a conspiracy on 9/11. The question, of course, is who were the central players in that conspiracy? But because they were able, through the BBC and CNN, to plant these images, if you go back through the transcripts and the tapes and so on of that day, you'll find about, I think, within 12 minutes of the first plane hitting the North Tower, someone is saying, "This looks like Al-Qaeda."
Yeah, very.
Now, on what basis could you possibly say that whatever it is Al-Qaeda, because you haven't conducted your forensic analysis, right? Who was Al-Qaeda? Well, Al-Qaeda was the name that Field McConnell's sister, Christine Marcy, gave to the Arab American database of the Small Business Administration. I mean, not that she speaks Arabic, or at least as far as I know, she doesn't speak Arabic, but she was the chief operating officer of the Small Business Administration on 9/11. And that's the name of the database where you recruit small companies that speak Arabic.
And that would be the EB-5 program that George Bush Sr. set up in 19...
These are the 8A... loans that are made to small American companies that permit them to bid on major contracts and weapons programs.
Oh, yes, yes. And that is just rife with fraud. That's how they fund the terror
network. It's been a fraud since 1968, and Christine Marcyfield's sister has been a fundamental, whether she's a witting or unwitting party, because, you see, what happens with those organizations, and happened on 9-1-1, is with every major weapons contractor, let's take Boeing. Boeing would be described under the Small Business Administration as a mentor company. And what Boeing was forced to do was to take on protege companies that were either black or veteran or disadvantaged, or I think one of the favorite ones is lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered. I mean, it's beyond a joke. So Boeing is forced to take on a certain percentage of these people in order to demonstrate it's invested in what they call diversity. Now, the problem is, if you bring in groups like that, it's not at all obvious that they share the same interest as most patriotic Americans, because maybe it's a group that says, we don't think lesbians get a big enough cut of Boeing's business. And again, like Field, I've got nothing against lesbians. I'm not interested. However, one of the fundamental ways of getting inside a powerful nation's intelligence service is to use sex. They call it the honeypot technique. The East Germans and the Russians have been doing it for decades. So the Americans will send an ambassador, I don't know, to East Germany or Russia or whatever, and they're a long way from home, and they walk into an ambush. And they're caught on film, and then they're extorted or blackmailed. Now, what we're really talking about here, of course, is the human intelligence network that it would appear Osama bin Laden was moving some of his assets on. So now, I think we've got the three networks. I think the three networks are electronic intelligence, human intelligence, and financial intelligence. Osama bin Laden, because he was way down in the pecking order, thought that they were independent networks, but they couldn't be, because in order to coordinate the 9-1-1 attack, someone had to be able to get into each of the three networks, so that when the saboteur brought down the second tower, or the team of saboteurs brought down the second tower, they got a percentage of the money from the catastrophe bond insurance that was triggered when the second tower came down. And in order to get the tower to come down and the right people trapped on the upper floor, you needed to be inside the electronic security system. So we think the human intelligence network is the Bullingdon Club in Oxford University that was founded in 1780. We think the Bullingdon Club was converted to a different purpose around the period 1876, when Cecil Rhodes became a member. In 1877, Cecil Rhodes writes his secret will that calls for the creation of an imperial parliament in London, with a few powerful people recruited through Oxford University to run the United States and Canada and Australia. In 1902, the House of Rothschild launches the Rhodes Scholarship Scheme. In 1926, the Rhodes Scholarship Scheme recruits Senator, well, he wasn't a senator then, Fulbright. And the Rothschild family tell Senator Fulbright, we will make you extremely powerful, extremely rich, etc. And we want you, and this was in 1947, to create a Fulbright program which will give cover for agents moving in and out of the United States through the university system.
Is the Russell Group involved in any of this?
Russell?
Russell, like with the Russell Trust and that sort.
Well, again, I don't know about the Russells, but let me tell you, the most powerful law firm for handling family trusts and corrupting them is Sidley Austin of Chicago.
Okay.
And from 1932 to 1952, the Sidley Austin law firm in Chicago that would one day employ Michelle Obama and Barack Obama and, more importantly, Bernardine Dorn, the leader of the terrorist underground movement, they renegotiated and restructured the Rockefeller Grandchildren Trust that had the estate of Edith Rockefeller McCormick. And what I say to people is, David Rockefeller doesn't have any power whatsoever because once a month he gets a check from the law firm. All the power is with the law firm because David Rockefeller won't know what the law firm is doing with the family trust and family investments. So you can see, you can take over a powerful family by laundering their money. And then telling them that they will be exposed or that the money in the family trust has disappeared if they don't do what they're told.
So you're trying to tell me that Rockefeller's a victim?
I'm not saying a victim, but when we think that David Rockefeller is powerful, let me back up here with Abraham Lincoln, right? Shot in 1865.
Uh-huh.
The family trust that went to the widow, Mary Lincoln, was managed by Sidley Austin. And Mary Lincoln was put in a lunatic asylum by Sidley Austin Law Firm. So you might think that the widow of the President of the United States has some kind of power, but she knew too much. They put her away. Now, I'm not saying the Rockefellers don't have power, but I'm saying that, in his particular case, he's 93 or 94, right? There's a whole bunch of children and grandchildren, an enormously complicated structure. No one Rockefeller, I would predict that no one Rothschild, for that matter, really know what the hell's going on. That's placed in the hands of agents. Now, a firm like Sidley Austin has got an international reach, and it's the world's number one law practice that handles hedge funds.
Do you know if there's any connection to McKinsey and Company? With either the Bullingdon Group or Sidley Austin?
I don't know, but, you know, it's the kind of thing I would Google when I had, when I finished here and see those kind of connections. But I have a phrase that all roads lead to the Bullingdon Club.
Yeah, well, the reason why I ask is because every time I encounter a consultant or somebody that came from the McKinsey and Company, they seem to be destroyers of companies. You know, they're hired in as consultants. They come in and the company gets destroyed in some way. So they're kind of like a Trojan horse.
I think that's a very good observation, particularly with these consultants. And my friend of mine used to say they borrow your watch and tell you the time. You know, essentially they come in as parasites. And that's an interesting observation, because if you go back to what Cecil Rhodes did, he built a global monopoly in the diamond area. And what they want is they want a global monopoly in each of the industries. They don't want competition. Now, very interestingly, Boeing moved its headquarters from Washington State to Chicago. And it was commissioning that building on the morning of 9/11. So all its directors were, how shall I put it, disrupted in terms of what was intended to be an assault on the shares of Boeing, and ultimately to scoop Boeing up and make it part of this new world order of electronic warfare and electronic intelligence systems run out of London. One of the directors of Boeing at that time was John Shalikashvili, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who handed, with Clinton's approval, all of America's military secrets over to the Communist Chinese.
Well, one of the things that I'm trying to find the connection here on is because you're talking a little bit about Osama bin Laden, and you have the Afghan thing, and the bin, and now I know that Osama would have a connection to his family's construction company, which I know was involved with the reconstruction after the first bombing of the Trade Center. But I don't understand where the tie-in comes in, where you have this set up with the Afghan thing, and then you have years prior where they're setting up and giving so much over to China. Unless, are you following what I'm saying?
Well, again, you need to go back, 200 years? I mean, the British were in Afghanistan and getting clobbered 150, 200 years ago. So the intelligence network, well, and in Pakistan and in India and Malaya and so on, the network built essentially by the Rothschilds, the intelligence network, was global. Before the Americans really got into international affairs, I suppose, with their entrance into the First World War.
Well, another thing that you brought up when you were talking about the borders or so-called friends. I mean, it's kind of like we're told we're friends with a country, but at the same time, why would there be an open border between these two countries when there isn't so much say in there wasn't so much say in Europe, but when you had open borders between Canada and Mexico, and that makes me kind of wonder if Britain all along considered us their colony and that we were their colonizer.
Well, this is the huge problem with the we. See, I mean, what, the 60 million Brits, right? The 300 and plus million Americans.
Uh-huh.
So when we say we the Brits and we the Americans, what I'm saying is the common man, John Doe, get on extremely well. You know, I've lived and worked in the United States. I've worked with Americans around the world, and it's just fantastic, you see. But when people higher up the ladder saying this is what your view should be of the United States, you have to process it out because it's garbage.
Right, and I mean, but it's kind of like that on numerous parts of the world, that the common person kind of has a tendency to take on the attitude that the leadership tells them that they need to in the treatment of people, when on an average normal basis, when we go into those places and that's not involved, we probably get along with them real well.
Well, exactly. And that's been my experience working around the world. So, again, this is the problem, if you will, of virtual deception. The resources available to the Rothschild, the House of Rothschild, and the Bullingdon Club, you know how much money they've accumulated through this credit default swapping electronically and the catastrophe bond triggering after 9/11. They created in December of 2000 the project at 10 Downing Street, which is the home of the British Prime Minister, called the Carbon Disclosure Project, which means you either tell them how much carbon you're producing, or you're punished through an assault on your shares, or maybe you're driven into bankruptcy. Anyway, that fund, or assets under management, has now got $64 trillion in it.
You know what? I've wondered if maybe they didn't create that fund because they're trying to replace the petrodollar with a carbon credit certificate dollar. But in order to do that, they have to, of course, control all of the monetaries. They basically have to buy up all the assets and revalue them.
Or destroy them. And the way to confiscate property is they're called debt for equity swaps or credit default swaps. I lend you money. Then I deem you to have violated some loan covenant. That triggers the swap, so I take your equity. And you see now, on 9/11, the world's biggest trader in sovereign debt, U.S. government securities and Eurobonds and carbon dioxide trading was in the top of the North Tower.
Oh, Cantor Fitzgerald.
Right, and its subsidiary eSpeed, which had sued the Chicago Board of Trade and Chicago Mercantile Exchange for a patent infringement of its hub-and-spoke trading software, and its carbon dioxide trader, CO2E.com. Mm-hmm. So they were tested on the 4th of June 2001 at the Windows of the World, given a test called the Kier Identity Test. And the Kier Identity Test measures how much carbon dioxide you think you should be allowed to produce. That is to say, you can fail your Kier Identity Test. Do you know who wrote the Kier Identity Test algorithm?
No, who?
Barack Obama.
Really?
In a contract with the Kellogg School of Management when he was a director of the Joyce Foundation. And Barack Obama is a Fulbright scholar. He was a Fulbright scholar at Occidental University, and you're only a Fulbright scholar at an American university if you're not a natural-born American. So he is not a natural-born American. And he was financed because the Fulbright scholarship scheme is financed by the House of Rothschild. Because Senator Fulbright was a Rhodes Scholar in 1927. And that was the deal of the devil. Basically, the Rothschild said to Fulbright, either before he came or when he was at Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar, we will give you a great career in politics with a lot of influence, but you've got to work diligently to dismantle the independence of the United States government.
So in other words, you're saying that they're utilizing the collegiate system with various scholarships and groups to bring in assets from other countries and
perfect cover.
Okay.
You see, the Unabomb, for example, the first Unabombs were launched out of Northwestern University in 1979. Right? That is the university where Bernardine Dorn, the leader of the Weather Underground organization, teaches at the School of Law today.
Is that one of the where the professor was a professor of the computer science department or something?
Well, the Northwestern University has the most powerful virtual deception facilities in the world, called the International Center for Advanced Internet Research. And I don't know the name of the particular professor you're referring to, but what the iCare at Northwestern University does, it's got a hard, wide bandwidth link to the University of Chicago, wonderful name for evil. The Electronic Visualization Lab.
Oh, wow.
So what the University of Chicago and iCare can do is literally cut and paste virtual images of an attack like 911, mixing in some fictional and some real, get it out on the internet and around the world 3 times before breakfast, before the other conspiracy theories can get up to speed, catch their breath, and work out from forensically who really did hit America on 911. So what I'm saying there is the first conspiracy theory becomes the fact, and all subsequent theories stay conspiracies.
Yeah.
And that was their great success. Now, in order to do that, they had to finance the construction of this, you can call it your planetary skin if you like, but Cisco, back in 1992-93, was working with the British Columbia Company, where I live, on the public key infrastructure system called Entrust. Have you heard of that, Vicki?
I vaguely recall, but I...
It's a certificate authority system which says that, for example, the President of the United States can authorize the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to act under the following circumstances. For example, if Air Force One was blown up.
So it's a rules-based kind of authority system.
It's a rules-set system. And these rules were set up algorithmically, and they're known as continuity of government rules. And they were set up during the Cold War period to provide continuity of government in the event of a nuclear attack. And various key command points in the American administration were taken out, either by nuclear or non-nuclear attack.
Yeah, but under whose jurisdiction does this come?
That is absolutely fundamental. Fundamental, because what you're asking there is a question that used to be asked in the 13th or 14th century in the UK, and it's called quo warranto, meaning by whose authority?
Well,
and normally, what if you get someone from the king who says, give me your money or whatever, they have to be able to prove to you they come with the authority of the king. And Vicky, what you said previously about information technology fraud, this is identity fraud on a massive scale, because senior commanders in the American military and the British military and the Canadian military and the Australian military and on 911 are getting their orders not from the President of the United States. He's being bypassed. Remember, George Bush was at a school. They parked him in a school reading a goat story.
Yeah. With a sign behind him that says, reading makes a country great.
Yeah, and that was a setup, because had George Bush been in position, remember, and people can be as insulting as they like about George Bush, my reading of it is, he was a very good fighter pilot with the Texas Air National Guard.
Hey, let me jump in there, David. David, would you remind the listeners that he was holding the goat story upside down, and that's a sign of extremis?
Yes. That's right. Apparently, according to Field, if you fly the flag upside down or something upside down, it's a signal, and that was used with prisoners of war that were being televised.
And it was
it's
also
a signal that they're acting under duress.
Yeah,
that is very interesting. Any
naval vessel that's flying their colors upside down, whether it's a Union Jack, the Stars and Stripes, or the flag of China, they're telling everyone within visual range that they're in extreme jeopardy. Or the proper term is extremis, extremis.
Well, that would account for the look on his face.
The greatest disservice that the media and the propagandists have done, and this is a school and a technique that goes back to Saul Alinsky in Chicago in the 1930s, they say there are very few people who can handle ridicule well. Now, if you look at the free ride that Obama has had in bringing socialism, even worse, communism down, and the total absence of due diligence on what he did, like how many Americans know he was in Pakistan in 1981 on a hunting trip in the same area as Osama bin Laden?
I would, if it was a handful, maybe.
So don't you realize... I mean, I'm not attacking you. I'm saying educated people who allow themselves to be persuaded by ridicule. Anyone can be ridiculed and made a fool of. Right? But fundamentally, George Bush, and correct me if I'm wrong, Phil, he got his discharge papers. And remember, they tried to forge his discharge papers. Dan Rather resigned, and these people are so stupid, they typed out some kind of comment that he was discharged, but the font on the paper wasn't available at that time on the IBM computer typewriter.
Mm-hmm.
They forged it. So they've created a legend of ridicule for George Bush, and they created an impression of infallibility for this clown Obama. And if you look at Obama, he has never done anything of value to anyone. He's a slum herder. He's a community organizer.
It's important to note that Acorn went out of business yesterday.
Huh.
Take away his teleprompter, and this guy is a buffoon. He knows nothing.
Mm-hmm. But what did they...
He never produced anything useful.
Now, would Acorn reinvented itself?
of course, they just come and they go. They call that limited hangouts, you know. People think that they've achieved something because Acorn is gone. But Acorn is a group of assets on these networks. The key to taking these people down is not to look too closely at the assets, because if it wasn't Obama, it would be someone else. Remember, I think there's 100,000 Fulbright scholars now around the world.
David, do the Rothschilds control Russia, the Soviet Union?
Yeah. Yes.
They do.
The Rothschilds sent a woman called Anna Louise Strong to Moscow. She married a Russian agronomist husband, and the Rothschilds were owed a lot of money by the Soviet Union, and they showed Stalin a way of paying back the loan, which was a system called dead peasant life insurance.
Oh,
I don't know if you've heard of that.
Is that why he killed so many?
Yeah, so Anna Louise Strong, who had a PhD out of the University of Chicago, we believe she was sent by the Rothschilds to, and she became the editor of the Moscow News, which was the first English language paper, in 1930. She married her Russian agronomist husband in 1932, I believe. And in 1932, they showed Stalin how to use a seed quota system for Ukraine, where the first 40% of production from the Ukrainian kulaks and peasants was taken by the state to be sold internationally to meet some of the debts. And then it would appear that the Soviet Union and the Rothschilds, they bought and sold what is known as dead peasant life insurance on the peasants. And they killed between 7 and 10 million people. And that was a quota system for seed in the food chain. So Anna Louise Strong is the cousin of Maurice Strong. And then Maurice Strong is the godfather of the quota for carbon dioxide.
Oh, man, so they've been paying, they've been at this genocide and murder for money for a long time then.
Yeah.
Depopulation.
Correct. And if you look at, have you heard of a society called the Fabian Society?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Okay, well, the founder of the Fabian Society was Cecil Rhodes.
Oh, wow, then, okay, well, it does all connect up then, doesn't it?
Yeah, and the general, the Roman general Fabius, there was another word that described, he had a wart on his nose, but his technique was with Hannibal, he decided that he wasn't strong enough to take on Hannibal head to head, so he developed the techniques of harassment and a scorched earth policy to remove the food and broke up the Hannibal's forces by using factions so that faction A would fight faction B. And that's exactly the technique that the Fabians have developed over the time. And this is what we think the Rothschilds did. You see, I don't think, and I don't mean this respectfully, I don't think America won the War of Independence.
I don't think they did either.
I'm not sure we won any wars.
Right, but Gary, you see, you don't win wars because the Fabians come in and they basically divide up your aggressive forces and you end up fighting each other. And it was done most brilliantly during the Vietnam War, because what the Brits did is they started funding riots on the campus in the United States. And the precursor to the Weather Underground organization was called the Students for Democratic Society. Mm-hmm. And there's an outfit in New York called the Business International Corporation, which hired Obama in 1984. And that's the front for the CIA and the Sabotage, Assassination, and Deception Group out of the UK. And it's now run by by the Economist paper in the United Kingdom, which is controlled by the Rothschilds.
So that's why you kept sending those articles, huh?
Yes.
I was wondering if there was something, a tie-in there on that.
Yeah, because now, you see, it was Saul Alinsky said, personalize, 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 and it's extremely difficult for everyone. It's not a question of being American, Canadian, Australian, or a Brit, to talk about an abstraction like the Illuminati or the Jews or the Rothschilds in general. But now we have a name, Nathaniel Rothschild, who was at Oxford University, was a Bullingdon Club member, right? He was at the family villa in Corfu and invited the son of Gaddafi. And 1 week later, they released the alleged bomber of the Pan Am 103 over Lockerbie. So we've got a face, you know, right at the heart of this. There's a guy called Nathaniel Rothschild, who seemed to have used exactly the same technique as his namesake and forebear used in 1815, i.e. an intelligence network to get prior information about the outcome of a battle. In the case of 911, it was the outcome of a war game, and then take a position in the stock market so you make a killing. Mm-hmm. They did it in 1815, and they did it on 9/11.
Well, if it worked once, it works just about every time.
See, and that's what's going to destroy them, because under the racketeering influenced and corrupt organization statute of the United States, that was introduced in 1970 because with organized crime's power, they couldn't get witnesses brave enough to stand up in court and drop in the people who should go to jail. So they separated the individual from the organization, and they said, if you can demonstrate that the organization has continuity and a certain modus operandi and is engaged in certain so-called predicate acts, which include murder for hire, for example, or money laundering, and you can get the judge and the jury to agree that, A, this is a racketeering influence corrupt organization, then if it's, so to speak, guilty of murder for hire and death results, then membership of that organization carries the same penalty, i.e. sentence of death.
So in other words, and this is where this is what I've come to my own conclusion on, is, you know, you can attribute it a lot to these different organizations and that sort, but it is criminal is the commonality, but they do work within a framework. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you go to our website and look up this court action, which Field filed on the 1st of May, 2007, we spent a long time thinking about this. We realized that we can't get a murder one conviction. These people are too powerful. They're superb at manipulating the courts. And to get a murder one conviction, you need beyond reasonable doubt from a jury. However, this is rather like OJ. You see, OJ was not hit with a murder one conviction, right? But the family of Nicole Simpson's boyfriend sued him for wrongful death. And they won in the civil courts, because that merely requires the balance of probability argument before a jury. So what Field did when he filed his case in 1st of May 2007 in Fargo, we went for a case which is the wrongful death associated with the events of 9/11, i.e. about 3,000 people, under racketeering influence corrupt organization statute, which gives you triple damages if you win.
So even if you're trying to go after these guys that are international of sorts, we're probably the only country that you could probably bring those type of...
You're absolutely right. So what our present logic is that we're writing, and you get this all the time, you see, but it's going out on our Yahoo group to 1,300 people. I know the Prime Minister of Canada just a little bit. We're on the radio quite a lot, and thank you for tonight's opportunity. And what Field and I argue is the first court to go into is the court of what's called the court of public conscience. We're not waiting outside the door to be let in. We're saying to the public in large, look, this is what you're dealing with. You're dealing with a racketeering influence and corrupt organization. Now, back then, we called it the Global Guardian because that was the name of the war game. So we thought it was a good name. What we didn't know then, but we know now, is if you combine, you know, the Osama bin Laden boast about the three networks, they weren't, and they never were, independent networks. They had to come to a common point, and the common point they come to is the House of Rothschild and the Bullingdon Club at Oxford University, which dates back to 1780, just after the War of Independence. And that club and that House of Rothschild has accumulated, through credit default swaps and insurance frauds, $64 trillion in a project called the Carbon Disclosure Project, registered out of 10 Downing Street, the home of the UK Prime Minister, in a joint venture with the Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors in New York.
Did you see that document that I found on the Paris Club? The Houston terms that they agreed to on September 11th, 1990, and it was they agreed to the debt swaps, the debt for nature swaps through the Paris Club. And the Paris Club, as I understand it, is kind of like the collector.
Yeah, well, they use this web of trustees and law firms and accounting, so that's very confusing. What one has to try to do is dig behind and find, I think the legal term is mens rea, the guilty mind. And that's the beauty of this continuity argument, because if we can demonstrate that what they did in 1815 with Nathaniel Rothschild on the London Stock Exchange is the same as what they did with Nathaniel Rothschild on the New York Stock Exchange and Chicago Stock Exchange on 9/11, well, you could. That's 200 years of continuity, isn't it?
Yeah, you'd have to have them tried in the world court, though, wouldn't you?
No. We want it done in the Southern District Court of New York, because that's where the that was given the total responsibility for cases involving the 9/11 attack. And you want to do it in the United States. You know what? If I was the President of the United States, I would kick the United Nations out. I'd give them 7 days to leave.
You and me both.
You know, the one thing, and I this is kind of shooting in the dark or whatever, but it makes me kind of wonder that any city that hosts a stock exchange would be a perfect target for a false flag event then.
Like in 1815. The London Stock Exchange.
Right.
We lost the Bank of England. You see, I believe you lost your power over your American dollar on 9/11 because, for example, just as most Americans don't know that it was the U.S. Naval Command Center in the Pentagon that was lost, they don't know that at the top of the North Tower was a $70 trillion a year business in sovereign debt. And that function, just like, you know, I asked the question, what do you think happened to the U.S. Naval Command Center functions after 9/11 when they were destroyed? What happens to the sovereign debt trading business of Cantor Fitzgerald at the top of the North Tower? Well, it went to 10 Downing Street in England.
But Maurice Strong was involved in on that somewhat, wasn't he?
Maurice Strong is an agent, right, okay, for the Rothschilds. And we talked very briefly, and I don't want to go into, you know, more of the gory details, but the idea of using a video of an oath-taking ceremony to capture young people and make sure that they stay loyal and silent for the rest of their lives. It's a bit like organized crime in America. Well, in 1952-53, Maurice Strong was in Kenya developing an oath-taking ceremony for the Mau Mau.
Huh.
And at his archived papers at Harvard University, you'll see that he describes, I haven't read the details, here's this guy, the founder of Kyoto and the carbon tax and so on. He's in Kenya, either teaching or participating or witnessing Mau Mau oath-taking ceremonies, and I won't go into the details, but they're beyond horrible. But do you know who he was working with?
was it Osama's dad or something?
Osama's grandfather.
Oh, grandfather. Okay.
Was Mau Mau. These are the people that are into necrophilia, zoophilia, and cannibalism. And when apparently you took a Mau Mau oath, you take it for your children and your grandchildren.
And then there's also a tie with him possibly picking up where Anna Strong took left off in China and Russia, particularly.
Anna Louise Strong is a PhD from the University of Chicago. She, we believe, was an agent for the Rothschilds. She taught Stalin how to use a quota system to kill lots of peasants and pay off debt through the insurance on the peasants. It looks like she taught Mao Zedong how to do the same thing in the Great Leap Forward. She's probably responsible for 50 million dead in the last century. This is an American citizen. She lived from, I think, 1889 to 1970. And Maurice Strong was born in 1929. He's still alive now, but living in Beijing. So he was hired through Sidley Austin Law Firm and the Rockefellers and the United Nations. And basically, I think she taught him how the use of an interruption in the food chain could kill lots of people and depopulate the planet. Hmm. So she used a seed quota. His idea is to use a carbon quota.
And the United States of America shut down the growing of wheat in the Ukraine and Russia by using the WB-57, and that's what brought the wall down in 1989. But having said that, David, Vicki, and Melody, I have to run off to another project. This is Field speaking, but could I have you, David, explain to them how to find the Able Danger blog spot so they can see
what we're doing? Right, isn't it nearly time up?
Yeah, it is. And I was going to just say we need to bring this to a close here now. So go ahead.
Let me do it. It's http://abledanger.blogspot.com. And that's the cutting edge intel source if you want to know what's going on in the world.
And I do want to thank you, Field and David and Vicki for another interesting interview this evening. And go ahead and finish up with any other thoughts, David and Vicki, and then we'll call it an evening.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and goodbye, Field. Now, if I just may say, if you Google Chelsea, that is Chelsea Clinton, and McKinsey, and Rhodes Scholar, asset stripping, you'll find exactly like you said, McKinsey is in the business of hiring relatives of traders, which I allege is Bill Clinton, and evidently very closely connected to the Rhodes Scholarship Scheme, which is financed by the Rockefeller, Rothschild.
Okay,
well, I'll say goodbye, and thank you very much for giving us the time on the show.
And thank you. It's very interesting tonight. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night, Marty. Good night, Vicki. Good night, Janet.
Good night.
Good night, everyone. Bye.